The world is supported by LegalZoom. We're halfway through the year, but it's never too late to get started on things you want to accomplish. LegalZoom can help you complete some of the things on your to-do list with their friends and family discount. For more information, visit LegalZoom.com.
Protesters versus police in Hong Kong, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Violence in Hong Kong today as police use tear gas and rubber bullets against demonstrators.
The brutality that we have seen earlier this afternoon is something that we've never seen before.
They're protesting a threat to allow Hong Kong residents to be put on trial in mainland China.
The conviction rate in the mainland is something like 98 or 99%. I just don't think it's because their prosecutors are that good.
Plus, are home delivery meal kits bad for the environment?
What we found is that the meal kits actually had lower environmental impact than the same meals from a grocery store.
And when you score 13 goals at the World Cup, people are gonna talk. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Dramatic scenes outside Hong Kong's Legislative Council today as police fired tear gas canisters against protesters. There were also violent clashes as police used batons to beat demonstrators and fired rubber bullets into the crowd. But protesters held their ground and achieved at least a temporary goal. They forced the Hong Kong government to postpone debate on a proposed extradition law.
But that doesn't mean they have won the whole thing, because the meeting can resume tomorrow, on Friday, next week.
That's Hong Kong journalist Chris Chang speaking with us from the scene of the demonstrations. The proposed law he's talking about, the one that has angered so many Hong Kong residents and sent them into the streets, would allow China to extradite Hong Kong citizens and prosecute them on the mainland. The demonstrators want to stop the proposal in its tracks. Today, Chang said demonstrators have built barricades in Hong Kong's central business district using materials they took from local construction sites.
They just got in and grab some of the materials, including bamboo sticks, metal plates, some other kinds of metal steel bars, whatnot, and created a makeshift barricade in front of the police.
And is there a literal standoff, like the riot police on one side, protesters on the other?
Exactly. Dozens of tear gas canisters have been shot at protesters, as well as reporters. So a lot of reporters felt sick afterwards as well. And I've seen ambulances getting into the main road occupied by protesters and carry away injured people.
Chris, who is on the street? Who are these protesters compared to that enormous demonstration a couple days ago? Is it similar types of people?
It could only really be young people, students who does not have to go to work, who have the passion to stay out the whole night in the central area of Hong Kong. There are some people who are possibly office worker who came after work because they are still in the suit and tie, but the majority of them are very, very young people, some even just under 18.
What do the protesters hope to do? What is their aim here?
Whenever they got into a confrontation with the police, they would shout, "Retract," as in retract the extradition bill. Because the whole point of this process was about this controversial bill that if passed, people in Hong Kong, anyone physically in Hong Kong, could be sent to China for trial, and no one trusts the legal system in mainland China. So the goal for the protesters is for the government to retract this bill.
Chris, you were on the streets in 2014. How do these protests compare to that?
Protesters themselves are way more prepared mentally and in terms of organization. It's not a central command ordering anyone to do anything, but it seems there is a consensus among protesters on what to do, how to organize, and how to share information. For example, in 2014, if tear gas canisters were shot at protesters, many would run away. But this time, the clear difference is that they will organize themselves in small groups, actually rush to the tear gas canister and pour water on it in order to stop the smoke from coming out. And also, they have more experience in informing themselves in the formation so that when police charge in, they would be in a better position to defend themselves. So I think after 5 years of different kinds of protests, organization, online debate, even argument between people, these protesters, although they are very, very young people, they're way more mentally prepared for this kind of protest than people in 2014.
Chris Chang is a Hong Kong journalist with the Hong Kong Free Press. He's been speaking to us from the streets of Hong Kong. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you.
The sheer number of people who've taken to the streets of Hong Kong and the forceful response from the police suggest that this is a unique moment in the Chinese territory's history. But the frustration many Hong Kongers are feeling now, that's not new. The World's Matthew Bell reports.
Hong Kong's leader Carrie Lam issued her first public statement since the start of this week's demonstrations, and she condemned the protesters. Everyone has witnessed the saddening scenes, Lam said. These were not peaceful rallies, and these people do not love Hong Kong. Lam said these protests are really organized riots. Lam went on to say that she hopes order can be restored as soon as possible, and she urged people who love Hong Kong to stay away from violence. But these are not a bunch of antisocial rioters, says Hong Kong native Casey Wong. He says it's the police who've been acting violently.
Before this past 2 days event, there was a big sentiment of wanting to run away from Hong Kong. If you ask, interview young people, they will just tell you they want to leave Hong Kong, but they cannot tell you where they want to run to. So this is a escape plan without destination.
Wong, who's a visual artist and an activist, says the anger and frustration in Hong Kong toward China has been building for a long time. When the British handed over the territory to Beijing in 1997, China agreed to preserve Hong Kong's unique political and legal status for a full 50 years. But Wong says the Chinese central government is failing to keep that promise.
In the recent time, in the past 10 years, in this kind of one country, two system have proven itself a lie. You know, slowly you can see from all sides, like education, the police, as well as an amendment of the law, disqualification of people's representative. It's all taking place, as well as the control of the media.
And control of the legal system. The extradition bill that sparked this week's protest would make it possible, for the first time, for mainland authorities in China to apprehend anyone in Hong Kong, even foreign visitors. Wong says it's hardly a surprise that people are saying no, they don't want to live under China's legal reality.
I think a lot of people don't understand how the court work in China. They don't provide a fair trial. They work for the police station. The police station, the police authority works for the Communist Party. They have a policy called the target policy. They'll first do the grab and snatch. And after they snatch the guy, then they will figure out the crime.
Here are the differences. You know, in Hong Kong, you're guaranteed a right to a lawyer, and you're actually going to get one.
Sophie Richardson is a China expert at Human Rights Watch. She says defendants in Hong Kong can see the evidence being used against them. They have a right to know what they're being charged with and the right to a trial.
It's exactly the opposite in the mainland. The overwhelming majority of people never have a lawyer at all. They frequently have no ability to know the evidence that's being presented against them. I think the conviction rate in the mainland is something like 98 or 99%. And I just don't think it's because their prosecutors are that good.
Richardson says China has been shutting down, one by one, the avenues for political participation in Hong Kong. Protesters have been saying they feel like this is their last chance to express their opposition to Beijing, and that these demonstrations are not likely to work. But Casey Wong says that doesn't mean they should give up.
We are fighting for that Hong Kong culture, the authentic, honest Hong Kong history, as well as our language, our way of living. That's what we're fighting for, and that's worth fighting for.
For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Today officially marks 1 year since President Trump's first summit with North Korea's Kim Jong-un in Singapore. Washington and Pyongyang remain in a stalemate over the North's nuclear program and American sanctions. Still, just yesterday, Trump had this praise for Kim.
I think North Korea has tremendous potential, and the one that feels that more than anybody is Kim Jong-un. He gets it.
Yeonmi Park disagrees. She escaped North Korea with her mother when she was 13 years old. She's living in New York now, and she clearly has no patience for Trump and Kim's song and dance.
It just makes no sense. We are living in a world right now in this 21st century. A dictator like Hitler can be praised. Kim Jong-un's job is oppressing people, killing his uncle, assassinating his half-brother. And that is perceived as a toughness and worthy of praise from the leader of free world, literally.
Do you think that that summit in Singapore and the fact that Kim Jong-un was out on the world stage, do you think that maybe that's affected him and made him have a better approach to human rights in North Korea? Do you see any indication of that?
You mean Kim Jong-un himself?
Kim Jong-un, yes.
Wow, no. That is North Korean human rights. It never been this worse, this oppressed than ever before under any Kim previously. The persecution for anybody in North Korea now is just so much worse than before.
So you think that the summit in Singapore last year gave Kim Jong-un credibility that he doesn't deserve?
Absolutely. That Trump gave him a platform to put a show to us to watch. And Kim Jong-un is a master at brainwashing people. He's a master at like manipulation. And that is what he's been doing to the rest of the world too. North Koreans are not the only ones who are brainwashed and being manipulated. The rest of the world is following his direction of believing this guy and believing this dictatorship and somehow think this guy is doing the right thing.
Yeonmi, you escaped North Korea at 13 with your mother. You made it to South Korea, and now you're in New York. You've been telling your story all over the world. You've even written a memoir about it. When people ask you about your experience, what's the one thing you tell them about North Korea?
The one thing that I want to tell the world about North Korea is that the media portrayed North Koreans as some brainwashed robots that has no humanity almost. But I just want to tell the people who are living there right now, 25 million people just like us, are just so unfortunate, just being punished for their birthplace. And that's all the North Koreans been done, you know. They just, all they did was born in that place, and that's the price they are paying for it.
So you want us to understand that the citizens of North Korea, they're not kind of, you know, brainwashed robots, that they're just like you and me, and
yeah,
they want the
course.
Same things?
They of course deserve the same things. If we deserve everything that we deserve here, of course they deserve the same thing because they are the same human beings.
Do you still have family in North Korea?
Yeah, it's that's a tricky question because as soon as I spoke out against the dictatorship, the North Korea regime portrayed entire my families and relatives in a propaganda video denouncing me as the propaganda machine of the West. And they've been all disappeared because of me. And I have no idea if they are still alive or sent to prison camp, or I have no idea. And that's why we are talking about Kim Jong-un. There's nothing got better under Kim Jong-un. It's getting worse.
You've called on Americans to urge President Trump to bring up human rights in North Korea with Kim Jong-un. It never happened at the Singapore meeting. Do you still think it could help if an American president put pressure on Kim Jong-un?
Of course, this is the most powerful country in the world. As the U.S., the president, if he acknowledged there is a human rights violation that has to be resolved, then that is a signaling the entire world. The entire world will know about it and we have to care about it. It's such a contradictory behavior by these politicians that I do not understand. If they care about, you know, life, how they are not caring about human rights but just caring about nuclear weapons?
Yeonmi Park is a human rights activist and a North Korean defector. She's now living in New York. Yeonmi, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Home delivery meal kits, good or bad for the planet? We'll tackle that question just ahead on The World.
The World's podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers at Goldman Sachs on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to the podcast Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. you'll hear discussions on a variety of topics from a variety of sectors with far-reaching implications, including global and regional growth forecasts, finding value in today's investing climate, the impact of technology on markets, and much, much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Home-delivered meal kits are a booming trend across the globe. You might have tried one, like HelloFresh or Blue Apron. All the fresh ingredients for a meal in a box delivered to your doorstep. They're super convenient, but they also have people wondering if meal kits are just another way we're harming the environment. The World's Jason Margolis digs in.
Every Wednesday is a big deal around my house. My wife, Amy, opens our big box of meals shipped from the company Gobble.
Ooh. First one is grilled lemon pepper chicken drumsticks with zucchini and summer tortellini salad.
It takes us 15 to 20 minutes to cook each one of these meals. My wife is faster. We make fewer trips to the grocery store, have fewer fights about what to eat, and get a tasty, healthy meal out of the deal. All good. But then there's the packaging.
Big pack of Nordic ice.
And the guilt that comes with it.
Cardboard divider thing.
We're not alone.
I had a number of friends who were subscribing to meal kit services and expressing a lot of guilt about the amount of plastics and packaging that were being produced.
Shelley Miller at the University of Michigan's School for Environment and Sustainability decided to investigate the carbon footprint of the meal kit boom. She compared the greenhouse gas emissions related to meal kits versus buying food at the grocery store. She pored through Department of Agriculture data and sent some undergrads to a local grocery store to replicate a meal kit. And
what we found is that the meal kits actually had lower environmental impact than the same meals from a grocery store.
Hard to believe, because at my house,
this is like a Mylar covered bubble wrap.
The amount of like trash and recycling we generate for just three meals seems obscene. Each meal comes in a plastic bag, then each ingredient comes in a smaller bag or container. Shelley Miller says people need to look at the big picture, though. She says we tend to focus on what we see right in front of us.
We don't actually see the environmental impacts that go into producing our food. But there's a lot of energy and a lot of fertilizers and a lot of pesticides that go into producing food. It's actually a very energy-intensive process.
Miller says food waste is the invisible problem. And when most of us go to the grocery store, there's a mismatch between what we buy and what we actually eat. Worldwide, about 30 to 40% of food gets wasted.
The nice thing about the meal kits is that they're perfectly proportioned to the recipe that we're buying.
Even if we were trying to recreate an exact meal kit recipe with our shopping list, not wasting food would still be a challenge.
So if the recipe calls for 2 chicken breasts and you can only find a package of 3 chicken breasts in the store, what do you do with that last chicken breast? Many of us will put it in the freezer and wait for another day. But then the problem is we forget about the chicken breast and it ends up in the freezer and freezer burned, and then we throw it out 3 months later.
Now, Miller adds a big caveat. Individual results vary. There's a huge number of moving parts when figuring something like this out. Transportation, packaging, air pollution, water quality. There's no simple formula here.
It's another case of the devils in the details.
Susan Selke directs the School of Packaging at Michigan State University.
If you're a responsible consumer, you certainly can shop at grocery stores and have less environmental impact than by having all your meals delivered in meal kits with all the associated extra packaging.
But it can be hard to be that responsible consumer. And Selke adds meal kit companies are trying to minimize their footprint.
Because packaging is an expense to the companies using it, they have an automatic economic incentive to try to spend less on packaging. We've turned out a lot of graduates over the years who go out to these companies and save them money.
And she says in most cases, less money spent on packaging means less environmental impact. Still, is there a better way? Kara Brocious has researched the meal kit industry with the Fredonia Group, a market research firm in Cleveland. She says U.S. consumers are buying the most meal kits, $3.1 billion worth a year, but the concept is booming across the planet.
Including Germany, the U.K., Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and France.
And China and India are on the meal kit horizon as e-commerce continues to grow in those countries. But the meal kit business model is also shifting. In the European Union, as well as parts of the U.S., there's a big push to cut down on household waste. And that's pushing meal kits into grocery stores where you don't need a big cardboard box, ice packs, and bubble wrap. Brocia says buying at the store can also be cheaper and actually easier.
You would think that delivery would be more convenient, but people do not want those packages to be out on their doorstep for a long time.
A mismatched delivery time can spoil everything, literally. So could meal kits bought at the grocery store hit the environmental sweet spot? Less food waste and packaging, and no more polluting diesel trucks coming right to my door just for me.
But that's just one package on a big truck that has a lot of packages.
Shelley Miller says if we're all driving to the grocery store, that's generally worse for the environment. Again, those pesky details. Now, if you walk to a farmer's market, bring a cloth bag, and eat all the food you buy, you clearly win the environmental sweepstakes. But for the rest of us who want to cook a decent meal and care for the planet, it's complicated. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
It's day 6 for Women's World Cup soccer in France, but the big news was on day 5, when the U.S. team, the defending world champions, set a record. They beat Thailand 13-0. That's the most lopsided victory ever in the history of the tournament. Not much of a contest, obviously, and by the time Carly Lloyd scored the 13th goal for the U.S.
Is it going to be 13? It is!
Even this FIFA TV commentator sounded pretty subdued. But the U.S. players themselves, they were pretty stoked all the way through. They celebrated each of the 13 goals with relish. And that got mixed reactions from commentators and fans around the globe, even here in the U.S. Some argued the celebrations by the players were excessive, bad sportsmanship even, given how lopsided the score was becoming. This American fan shared her advice for the American players with the BBC.
You could, tone down the celebration.
By the way, we're not identifying her by name because this has become a pretty heated argument. One commentator on Canadian TV says she got death threats from viewers after she criticized the U.S. celebrations. In any case, plenty of fans think the American athletes did nothing wrong. In fact, many applauded the players for not letting up during a match at the World Cup, the biggest stage for their sport. And after the game, star forward Alex Morgan was unapologetic.
We really just came into this game, really wanted to showcase ourselves and what we've been preparing for and what we've been working on. And I think we did that, but every goal matters in this tournament. And so that's what we were working on this game.
We'll let Morgan have the last word here. She deserves it. Morgan put 5 in the net yesterday, tying the record for most goals scored in a single World Cup game. I'm Carol Hills. A remote island off the coast of Panama has almost no people, but it does have a lot of monkeys, and they've got some skills.
This is really unique. It's the first time that this particular genus of monkeys has ever been seen to use stone tools. And so it's a really exciting discovery.
Coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, arrived in Tehran today. It's the first visit to Iran by a Japanese leader in more than 4 decades. And one of Abe's main goals is to ease tensions between Tehran and Washington, tensions that have risen significantly since the U.S. reimposed sanctions on Iran over its nuclear program. And when the U.S. deployed an aircraft carrier to the region to protect against an specified Iranian threat, there were concerns that a regional conflict could erupt, something Abe nodded to ahead of his trip to Tehran.
There are concerns over growing Middle East tensions. The world is focused on this region, and Japan wants to do as much as possible to secure peace and stability in the Middle East. I hope to have candid talks with the Iranian President Hassan Rouhani and the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei in order to ease tensions based on the long friendship between Iran and Japan.
This week on the show, we're hearing how Iranian Americans are feeling about all of this. Yesterday, we met Homa Sarshar, a radio host in Los Angeles, who was forced to flee her native Iran at the time of the revolution. Today, we're going to hear from a younger generation of Iranian Americans, many of whom are nervous about what the future holds for them. I'll let the world's Shirin Jafari take it from here.
So is this it?
Oh, yes, this is the school.
On a beautiful day, I meet with Yalda Modaber, the head of Golestan Kids School in El Cerrito, across the bay from San Francisco. She leads me through the school's main entrance, which opens onto a playground. Yalda walks up to a tree at the edge of the playground.
Lots of plants.
Would you like a mulberry?
Oh my God, is that mulberry?
Toot.
Toot. That's the Persian word for mulberry. She picks one of the long purple berries and hands it to me. The sweet, juicy berry takes me back to my childhood in Iran.
This area here.
Golestan offers a Persian language immersion program to students. Yada, who was born in the U.S. to Iranian parents, came up with the idea for the school because of her son.
My Persian wasn't very strong, and I needed support in teaching my child Persian, and I also needed childcare.
But there was nothing like it in California, she says. And that in a state with the largest Iranian population outside of Iran. I ask her why.
I think a lot of people, when they immigrate, they want to assimilate, and so maintaining their heritage language isn't a priority. We're now second generation. We're the ones who are really holding on to our heritage for dear life. And I think that we are more driven to create something like this.
More driven than her parents. They belong to that generation of Iranians who immigrated to the United States during the 1979 Islamic Revolution. In November of that year, Iranian students took a group of Americans at the U.S. Embassy hostage. This sparked a crisis between the two countries that lasted for more than a year.
Some 60 Americans, including our fellow citizen whom you just saw, bound.
The standoff got non-stop coverage in the U.S. media. No wonder Yalda's parents' generation didn't flaunt their nationality.
People that were close to me were threatened with violence because of the hostage crisis.
Persis Karim directs the Center for Iranian Diaspora Studies at San Francisco State University.
My own father didn't tell people he was Iranian. He said he was Greek to avoid any association.
Karim says despite all the trauma that Iranians endured, many went on to flourish in this country. In Silicon Valley, for example, the CEO of Uber is Iranian-American. There are top Iranian-Americans at companies like eBay, Airbnb, and Google.
There are scientists, engineers, but there are also artists and filmmakers and poets.
But the tensions between Iran and the U.S. have persisted, and Iranian-Americans with ties to both countries can't escape it. Shortly after President Trump took office, he announced a travel ban. The executive order separates thousands of families, including Iranians. Last year, Trump walked away from the Iran nuclear deal that President Obama and other leaders had negotiated with Iran. Now, some American politicians are threatening military action.
Could we win a war with Iran?
Yes.
That didn't take you a second.
Two strikes, the first strike and the last strike.
This is Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton last month on PBS.
What are the conditions or the circumstances that would justify going to war with Iran?
It's extremely anxiety-provoking. I mean, especially after the U.S. withdrew out of the nuclear deal, it was like a new dawn of disappointment.
Gelare Khoshgozaran moved from Iran to California 10 years ago. She's an artist in her 30s. Most of Gelare's family still live in Iran, so she worries every time she hears whispers of war.
I think about friends and family and people that I even don't know who still live in Iran, and you know, their survival, their health, their well-being is at stake.
It's on the minds of many Iranian Americans. How will things work out for them? At the Golestan School, I sit down with Navid Aslani, a tech consultant. He's thinking of enrolling his 4-year-old son here. I ask Aslani how much he tells his son, Rama, about the animosity between the two countries.
It's a good question. I think, you know, growing up here myself.
Aslani tells me about the time he was growing up in Kansas. His family had just moved to the U.S. and he had a hard time adjusting. One time, his classmates glued a picture of Ayatollah Khomeini on his locker. Khomeini was the intense-looking, bearded guy who led the Islamic Revolution in Iran.
I think my experience of having gone through that, I'm a little more conscientious about the importance of certain things. Like, do I want Rama to be in a situation where he's not accepted, but then his learning, supposedly...
Aslani says he's still figuring out how much he wants to share with his son. He knows Rama will have questions soon, just like he had when he was growing up in Kansas. But there's one thing he's clear about.
There's a deeper connection with Iran, no doubt. It's something that we were born into, so it's part of our roots. So I definitely want him to carry that with him. And we also love the U.S. culture. So what ideally is to be in an environment where he is nurturing his roots, but then he's also tapping into all the wonderful things that this country has to offer.
Rama, who has big brown eyes, is already making friends at this school, even though it's his first time here. He's busy playing a game and speaking with his new friends in a mix of Persian and English. For The World, Shirin Jafari, El Cerrito, California.
Yesterday, we reported that investigative reporter Ivan Golunov was released from house arrest in Russia after authorities there dropped their case against him. It seemed like a victory for protesters who'd taken to the streets to denounce Golunov's arrest and what they said were trumped-up drug charges. But today, there were more protests in Moscow. And more arrests. The BBC's Olga Ivshina is back to tell us what happened.
More than 420 people were detained today in Moscow. Most of them weren't arrested. Most of them were released a few hours following their detention, but some can be held for 48 hours, 24 hours. It will depend on court decision.
I know opposition politician Alexei Navalny was detained. What was he charged with?
It's actually a rare case when Alexei Navalny is participating in a rally, but he's not an organizer and he's not the main figure. So that was this rare case. He came just an ordinary participant of the rally. He was detained as usual. That's quite usual. He's now accused of being an organizer of this rally, which is not true.
And is he still detained or was he detained and then let go?
He's still detained as far as I know.
So what was the original reason for today's rally?
Yeah, this rally was announced a few days before when Ivan Golunov, Russia's independent journalist, was still detained and was kept under house arrest. It was a rally demanding his freedom. Since the news about his about the fact that the charges were dropped, various people had mixed feelings whether to go or not to go on a rally today. And interesting, my colleagues spoke to people on the streets and they had completely different agendas. Some of them were political activists campaigning to go there against the government. Some were there in support, still in support for Ivan Golunov. There would be one more rally if few days later on the 16th of June, so there are still more things to follow.
I understand at today's rally there were people shouting stop police terror. Did you hear that?
Yeah, if you look at the polls figures, the majority of Russians don't trust the police at all.
Why not?
Well, for example, just one example, if you look at the charges which Ivan Golunov got on Thursday, so charges on drug dealing on a mass scale, as we all found out yesterday, you know, there was absolutely no evidence. And if you look at the figures, 25% of all prisoners in Russia are there due to drug dealing charges. And then if you then look at the mathematical distribution, mathematical statistics of the amount of drugs they were detained with, it's in almost 100% of cases, they had as much drug amount as was needed for the case to be open. Hmm. Not less, not more, as much as needed. It doesn't prove anything, but from the statistical point of view, it's very, very suspicious because the curve should be different.
So they suggest there's a recipe for being able to arrest somebody on a drug charge.
Yeah, it's not the first time, you know, Russian police comes under huge strike.
What are those who are attending these rallies, what do they want to see happen?
Well, it depends, you know, because their agenda is completely different. Some are political activists like Alexei Navalny. Others are just ordinary people who have no relation to politics. Others protest against actions of the police. So their agenda is different. The only thing which unites them is they want change, because people don't see changes, you know, things don't change, the economy is not growing, people experience troubles, there is no political change, people are not enjoying consumption anymore because they're in trouble economically. People demand change and they don't see many channels through which they can talk to government, they can talk to officials. That's why some people tend to establish this dialogue through such rallies, through going to the streets and joining various protest movements.
The BBC's Olga Ivshina. Thanks a lot, Olga.
Thank you.
The Smithsonian Institution, with all its free museums, is a favorite with tourists in Washington. But what many people may not know is that the Smithsonian was founded by an Englishman who never set foot in the United States. This week, his descendants toured the museums for the first time, and Michaela Lafrac of Station WAMU in Washington was there.
A group of about 30 people walks through the Smithsonian Castle on the National Mall. They're in an area that's usually closed to the public, so they get to see some treasures regular visitors don't normally see, like Thomas Edison's first light bulb.
You're enjoying all this?
Splendid.
I think it's terrific. Very interesting.
Most in the group hail from the UK and Canada, and they're here to see the museums founded by their distant relative, James Smithson.
Well, we are a long way away in the family tree, but we are related.
That's Robert Hungerford from Vancouver. Smithson's mother was a Hungerford, too. And everyone in this group touring Washington traces back their roots to her family.
So this is my sister-in-law, my brother-in-law, my wife, my cousins. This is my nephew. This is my niece. This is my brother.
Oh, wow. So this is quite the family reunion.
It is, yes.
James Smithson was born out of wedlock in 18th century England. In those days, being an illegitimate child would have limited his options. But still, Smithson managed to become a successful chemist during an exciting time, the Age of Enlightenment. And then he inherited a fortune from his mother's side of the family, the Hungerfords. He never married or had children. So when Smithson died in 1829, there were no obvious heirs. Instead, he decided to donate his wealth to a country he'd never been to, the United States, specifically to found, quote, an institution of knowledge in Washington. Or, as Smithsonian Ambassador-at-Large Richard Curran puts it...
So there was no direct descendants. We're the direct... The Smithsonian Institution is the direct descendant, legally.
And what a lucky descendant it was. Smithson's inheritance was worth about $500,000 at the time of his will. That's roughly $13 million in today's dollars, at least. Maybe much more, depending on how you do the math. Anyway, it was enough to plant the seed for what's now the world's largest museum and research complex. Last year, nearly 30 million people visited the Smithsonian, which includes 19 museums and the National Zoo. Patrick Hungerford, from Hungerford, England, helped organize this week's visit by Smithson descendants to Washington. He, for one, is very proud of his ancestors' legacy.
He made a difference, and that is so important in life. He didn't want all the flumery of worrying about hereditary. And that spirit epitomizes the Smithsonian today, I think.
For the World, Michaela Lafrac, Washington, D.C.
We've been hearing a lot recently about the extinction crisis, animals, plants, and other organisms disappearing at an alarming rate as humans transform the planet. Most of the concern has been about losing whole species, but scientists say losing even smaller populations of animals, for example, could be hugely significant. That was brought home recently by a discovery on a group of isolated islands in Panama, a discovery that involves monkeys using tools. Our story comes from reporter and scientist Kevin McLean.
It's the end of a long, dry season in the islands of Coiba National Park off the Pacific coast of Panama, and Claudio Montesa is leading a team of researchers over a dry stream bed.
That reminds me to the smell on a little patch of forest that is in the back of my home.
Claudio grew up in one of the coastal provinces nearby. Now he's a PhD student in animal behavior. We work in the same lab at the University of California, Davis, but on this trip, I'm mostly just an extra pair of hands. As we scramble into the forest, we hear the roaring calls of a howler monkey. But we're more interested in another kind of monkey here, the ones making those little barking sounds. They're capuchin monkeys. They're about the size of a house cat, and they scream at us, shake branches, and show their teeth, trying to scare off the intruders. These guys have had free reign of these islands for thousands of years. With no large predators on the ground, they spend a lot of time on the forest floor. And a few years ago, Claudio says scientists working here noticed something strange.
Well, it's very abstract, but it's basically a stone on top of another stone.
A stone on top of another stone.
And that probably have no meaning, but when you think about the way things are in this river, stones are hardly on top of each other. And in few occasions, some of them were surrounded by snail pieces.
The snail pieces seem to be a hint that there was a purpose to these stacks of stones. So Claudio set up some cameras to see what was going on. In the videos, you can see capuchin monkeys placing snails, clams, and nuts on a large, flat rock, then using a small stone to hammer them open. Or sometimes they come waddling up on two legs with a big stone in both arms and drop it, like an anvil.
Monkeys are using stone tools to crack nuts.
Meg Crowfoot is the director of the Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior in Germany. She's leading this project.
This is really unique. It's the first time that this particular genus of monkeys has ever been seen to use stone tools. And so it's a really exciting discovery.
No one knows when or how the monkeys learned to do this. And the few people who've been here in recent decades probably weren't paying much attention to the monkeys.
Cuba was a place for dangerous people.
For nearly a century, some of these islands were used as a prison colony. At one point, we stumble upon the ruins of an old building. It's covered in vines, and the bars on the windows are covered in rust.
And it's actually the one that really shows the story of Coiba Island as a prison.
We look into one of the cells and see faded writing on the walls.
And it's very broken message, but it's something about asking for compassion and forgiveness and love.
Prisoners like the one who wrote that haunting message were held here until just 15 years ago. So the whole archipelago was pretty much left alone, while forests on Panama's mainland were getting chopped down. That's what makes the island so special now to researchers.
This is not an academy.
And they're still making discoveries. Recently, they found evidence that capuchin monkeys might be using stone tools on a second island. So the behavior could be more widespread than they'd thought. And that's got Meg Crowfoot thinking about the future of these animals and the rest of the natural world.
One of the things that's becoming increasingly clear is that if we care about preserving the richness of the world around us, we have to care not just about species and genetics, but we also have to care about behavioral diversity, cultural diversity.
Just like having a diverse gene pool helps living things adapt and persist, survival also depends on a diverse set of behaviors that are passed from generation to generation.
And I think reshaping how we think about what diversity matters, what diversity do we care about, is important as we sort of continue into this period of time where animal populations are disappearing at a tremendous rate.
And despite its isolation, this island ecosystem is facing some of the same pressures as the rest of the world. Climate models predict that tropical forests like these are going to get warmer and drier. That means new challenges for their inhabitants. There's also concern about growing pressure from tourism. Everyone's thinking about the future here.
If you lose a place like Coiba National Park, you lose this connection to who we are as a species, and you lose an opportunity for understanding where we came from and how we got to where we are.
The capuchin monkeys here have adapted to their unique environment by descending to the ground and starting to use tools, just like our own human ancestors. Discovering this gives researchers a unique opportunity to learn what drives an animal to innovate. It's also a reminder of what's at stake amid a huge wave of global changes. For the World, Kevin McLean, Coiba National Park, Panama.
We have video clips of the Capuchin monkeys with their white faces and shoulders hammering away with stones. That's at theworld.org. A group working to bring attention to climate change just got a big helping hand from the British band Radiohead, thanks to an online troll. Radiohead guitarist and composer Johnny Greenwood announced the hack in a tweet.
We got hacked last week.
That's not actually Johnny Greenwood, just one of our producers doing a bad impression. Anyway.
Someone stole Tom's mini-disc archive from around the time of OK Computer and reportedly demanded $150,000 on threat of releasing it.
Tom would be Tom York, Radiohead's lead singer. OK Computer was one of the biggest albums of 1997. So maybe Radiohead wasn't hacked exactly. It was just a plain old theft of recordings on mini-disc. The culprit was threatening to release the tracks online, even though those 18 hours of demos and musical musings on those discs had actually been kicking around the internet for a few days already. But anyway, back to climate change. Radiohead reacted by making all those recordings available on Bandcamp, so you don't need to troll the dark web to get them. And proceeds from online sales there will benefit a British social action group called Extinction Rebellion, the group that shut down central London with climate change protests this spring. Radiohead might not know a hacker when they see one, but they know how to turn an online nuisance into a savvy move for their fans. We'll bid you farewell today with a short blast from those 18 hours, because to quote Johnny Greenwood,
it's only tangentially interesting and very, very long.
We asked around the world's newsroom, and yep, there's some Radiohead fans among us. We've made a Radiohead playlist on Spotify. It's at PRI The World on Spotify. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
RI, Public Radio International.